First of all, I'd like to thank the speaker for coming. It's a great pleasure to welcome him. Thank the organisers. Sorry, it's my last day, so they got me. And, just before I leave. thank them very much for a stimulating meeting. So, it's meant to be a discussion, but I have a lot of material, so I'm pretty sure I'm not going to cover it all, especially with some of the things I say, and I'm sure you'll want to have your say about them. But I think there are basically three areas that I thought we might consider today, and one is first of all, just a review of this debate that's going on in the bouncing cosmology group of people, and that is, what is the spectrum of density perturbations that is inherited today in the universe we see? Is it the steep blue spectrum, as those of us who've worked on pre-Big Bang type scenarios have derived for the dilaton and the scalar perturbations of the metric? Or is it a scale invariant spectrum, which those of us who've worked on pre-Big Bang have also derived for the axion? Which I think you might be interested in, to see the axions clearly play in these asymmetric tensor fields, clearly play a fundamental role in string theory. One of the nice things that I've seen over the last few weeks has been the role of these asymmetric tensor fields in stabilizing everything. But they could actually be pretty important for structure formation, in that the axion field itself can lead to a scale invariant perturbation. And but this isn't the debate, particularly to do with the axion. The debate is about the scale invariance that arises out of the work of primarily of Churok, Steinhardt, and their collaborators, investigating the ekpyrotic scenario, the colliding brains, where they actually will pass through a singularity, and they'll look at the evolution of perturbation through that singularity. And they claim that, in fact, the dominant mode that they pick up corresponds to a scale invariant spectrum. Okay, so what I would like to do first is just show you how you can get both, how it's possible. And then, then I might mention the axion in the context of obtaining a scale invariant spectrum associated with the pre-Big Bang. Discuss a little bit the role of matching, which I think is crucial in our understanding of what we're going to inherit. So these are singular space-times that we're ending up somehow evolving a perturbation through. Things are blowing up. The scale factors are going off to zero. Curvature terms are diverging on you, density terms are diverging on you, and yet you're evolving this small fluctuation through there. And you're cutting the system off. You're introducing a cutoff scale as we do in pre-Big Bang, where we don't let the system run all the way through to a collapse all the way through to zero scale factor. We'll say, well, at some particular size we expect higher order terms arising out of string theory. As you move into strong coupling regimes, we expect those terms to become important. So we'll cut the system off, and then we'll just match over onto the other side. And how you do these matching seems to be important in determining which of these spectra, if any, you're going to inherit. So this is work that I've been doing here with David Wan. So I'll try and give you a flavor. And then I don't think I'm going to reach this unless we just carry on all afternoon, and that is to try and give you an idea of how, in the like pyrotic and cyclic scenarios, they go about determining their matching conditions and why they argue that they will inherit a scale invariant spectrum, and their claim is that this is a real 5D effect, that the actual scale invariant contribution that they pick up in has a length scale in it which is corresponding to basically to the anti-de Sitter radius. So it's a real 5D effect. Okay, there's a lot of literature out there, and I should give you a flavor for some of them. So the ekpyrotic I've got down here is, you can, the most recent version you can pick up in HEP theory. There's a review, a number of reviews which have references to some of the literature on perturbations in the pre-Big Bang, and that's one that Jim Lidsey, David, and myself wrote, which is HEP theory 99090061. And then there's a number of people have written more recently about blue versus scale invariant. David Lythe wrote a paper, HEP phenomenology 06153. There's one by Jura and Venizzi, which is also HEP phenomenology 02032275. And there's one that I'll be making use of, which is by Cartier, Cyril Cartier, Jura, and myself, which is HEP theory 03011198. Okay, that's my exhaustive coverage of the referencing. So let's just have some framework to begin with, and let's consider the low energy four-dimensional low energy action, which would correspond to, say, low energy string theory. So we have, in the Einstein frame, a curvature term. We have the effect of dilaton in four dimensions, which is related to the dilaton in 10 dimensions through, it's got a volume factor representing the moduli of the Calabi-Yau, or whatever compactification you're assuming. You can put in a term for that evolving space if you want. I won't refer back to it, but and these are minimally coupled scalars, right? They're stiff fluids, but the axion is slightly different in that it has a non-minimal coupling. This is from another Schwartz sector. It has a non-minimal coupling through to the dilaton. And this non-minimal coupling, whereas these will generally lead you to a blue spectrum, the presence of the non-minimal coupling here can lead you to a different spectrum. It will be an isocurvature perturbation, which is not what we see. And so you have to invoke, this is where Gabrielle the other day was talking about moving into corners of, you have to make more and more assumptions that certain things happen. We're going to have to convert, if this is the way through to get the scale invariant spectrum that we see today, then we have to do something with it. And that's where ideas like the curvaton could come in handy, where it provides you with a mechanism for converting an isocurvature perturbation into an adiabatic. So you would have to couple this to another field. Sigma.
Okay.
So it's just the. Yeah.
Actually, you have more pseudo scalars if you want.
Oh yeah, you can go to
more axions.
More and more axions, and then they produce their own spectral index as well.
And this is the Einstein frame, so the matter fields are not minimally coupled. If you had matter fields, they would not.
They would
be interacting with phi as well. As
yeah, if you'd have had them, yeah, in the, if you'd have had the, them as minimally coupled in the string frame, then they'll pick up a phi interaction here. So I can think about solving this system.
Very good, thank you.
And a solution, there are a number of them, but in the Einstein frame is a collapse. But the scale factor is a function of eta, where the scale factor is going as eta to the half. Okay. And all the models that I'm describing have this kind of generic behavior. The effective four-dimensional scale factor is collapsing in the Einstein frame. But let me stress a difference in approach now, which is that in the type of calculations that we do with rolling radii, the pre-Big Bang type, we would argue that there's going to be some cutoff scale, what may be called eta string, where you would expect the corresponding solution for the e to the phi, the string coupling, is going from a weak coupling regime through to a strong coupling regime. It's diverging on you, your solution. And so you might associate this time e to s to where this perhaps becomes of order 1. And so you're expecting g string to become strong. Yeah.
Oh, well, I was just wondering. So the stress tensor that's driving the collapse is just from phi?
Just from the kinetic energy, yeah. And so we could think about just, and in the calculations that people do, we tend to just cut this off at this point and then match somehow onto that point. Now, there are models where, so we sort of don't want the singularity. Now, you can cook up models which avoids the singularity. Gabriel started that a number of years ago, and a number of us have worked on adding in higher order terms, r squared terms, grad phi to the 4 terms. You can add them in, and sure enough, you can round this out. But one of the issues, I think, that faces this subject and why perhaps string theorists haven't really got into it is that we don't know what those terms should be, as far as I can tell. And so any conclusion you arrive out of adding in a certain combination of higher order terms, you just don't know how general that conclusion is, as opposed to being specific to that model.
Is there more than one way to do it? Can you show that the answers are the same every way? Just make the background scale factor non-dynamical and just put a little
potential
there by hand? All the pervadings to it.
You can certainly model, make it yes, effectively. I mean, yeah, you can modify that. You can, in this regime, have a scale factor which interpolates between this and this just by that. Yes,
right.
That we do that.
And then do you get the same answer as just by doing the matching, or close enough?
Oh, yeah, you get very close. But whether or not that's telling you anything.
This is part of actually what the debate recently has been about, as to how, does it matter how you do that interpolation? Do you get a unique answer?
Yeah.
So, for instance, Cartier et al. Paper, Edson Root and Silva Cartier actually gave two different prescriptions, they gave two different answers.
So that's what I was going to
add.
Yeah, I've done both.
But I don't know. I mean, the ambiguity seems to be perhaps of a different sort. I thought that if you really round up the geometry, then the result is quite robust. However, if you insist that the geometry is singular and you want nonetheless to evolve your perturbations, then there are more ambiguities. I don't know. Well, is that your feeling too?
If you
just round up, or, you know, just change the scale factor in such a way that it becomes non-singular. And then compute perturbations on large scales. I thought in that case, the result is robust.
So for example, yes, in that, depending which of the scalar invariants you're calculating, you know, zeta or phi, they will proceed through. So zeta could be continuous and would go through and would give you a blue spectrum. But if you had your condition set up so that phi was continuous, then that would also go through.
If you make the background continuous and regular, then I thought there is no ambiguity.
I think there is still potential ambiguity, yeah.
And what is the ambiguity correspond to? It corresponds to different prescriptions for regularizing giving different results.
You see, that's precisely the point I wanted to come to. My feeling is that, sorry, you should answer that.
No, go on, I don't mind.
What I was saying is that, in my opinion, if you make the model regular, then, okay, there are some results which depend on exactly how you make it regular. And this is typically what the short scales or high frequencies feel. But the modes which are far away, far outside the horizon during the bounds, don't feel those details. But I don't know, maybe.
And that result doesn't depend on the value of beta s, where you cut it off? I mean, there are two ways of looking at it.
That ADAS will determine at which frequency the modification matters.
So if you make it smaller and smaller, you get more and more modifications.
K iteres, so it'll affect K larger, yes.
On large scales. But maybe a bigger modification at short scale.
So I think there are two issues in some sense. One is the regularization, which you have to, I mean, I suppose this is a sort of regularization. You're just cutting things off, and that's one thing you're doing. But even in this context, you've then got various choices of gauge invariant quantities that you can calculate. You can calculate, co-moving hypersurfaces, or you can calculate Bardeen potentials, and you can look at the associated power, if you like, power spectrum associated with each of these, and they generally will have different power spectra. And one of the questions that's been addressed is which of the matching surfaces should you be using? Traditionally, we use zeta, which is well-defined in an expanding universe, matches on to the Bardeen potential today in a radiation-dominated universe. They're proportional to one another. But they differ in a collapsing phase. And what we have normally assumed is that zeta is okay to use, and that's what we're trying to establish in this work here. And by using zeta generally, that's what I was probably going to try and reach, is that you will pick up a blue spectrum in this case. And indeed,
can I just ask a naive question since it's a discussion?
Yeah.
I mean, so this is some, I take it this is some low energy approximation of all theories, and it's good to imagine expanding it out with all powers of terms. Is it known whether the singularity is removed if you include all the terms, or is it expected, or what is the status of it?
Over to the string people.
Okay.
I don't think. I am.
No, I think it's not known.
Not known.
And I think this is a big assumption that everyone in this game makes. If we're just going to assume that there's a bounce and then try to see what that would predict. But I don't think
there's
any real calculation.
There's no singularity. Which you reject. A different description that doesn't have.
We have not done any calculations in full string theory which tells us whether these type of cosmological singularities are resolved or not.
So this is some sort of phenomenology?
Oh, completely.
Okay. There is one case which is the epirotic spectrum in which if you look at things from a higher dimensional point of view, you go from 10 to 11, or from 4 to 5, then in this larger dimensional space, the space-time is Minkowski. However, it's Milner, actually. I mean, it's some contracting universe, but the method is flat.
There's no singularity.
But there is a singularity, right? I don't know, how would you describe the singularity in that case, from a general relativity point of view?
The first dimension is going to zero. Yeah. To zero. So there is a singularity in this.
In that sense. There is no curvature singularity outside this origin.
There is still a singularity in strict Mill because the space is geodesically incomplete at the origin.
No curvatures.
There's no curvature singularity, but it's been shown that, you know, that is very unstable. Right? The slightest perturbation will produce curvature.
Yes.
Curvature singularity. So our view is that that's not any simpler than the real curvature singularities that you see in these cases. One has to deal with the problem.
And the big problem is that you have to deal with strong couplings, time-dependent solutions, and high curvatures are strong coupling. And this is precisely a regime where you don't know much.
So the difference that I was going to point out, well, you've just referred to it really, with the cyclic and ekpyrotic, they will not introduce a cutoff scale. This, and they're solving compactified Milne and go right through this point. Okay, and pop out the other side. So and the matching conditions that they have, our matching conditions, and the pre-Big Bang type things will tell us how to go from here over to here, using some source of energy, and then using Israel junction conditions. The equivalent matching conditions they will impose are such that they argue will allow for them to evolve their perturbations smoothly through this regime.
And so is it really exactly Israel matching conditions with some space-like energy?
Yeah, I think so. That's what.
That's what it's going to.
That's what.
It's not what. It's not.
No, what they do.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry, I didn't understand that. You have matching conditions where you have some space-like sheet of stress energy. So you specify the stress energy first, and then derive matching conditions from that, or you reckon the matching conditions, and then you say, well, these are the conditions I want, and therefore there must be a sheet of stress energy here which enforces them.
So I assume that the matching conditions actually correspond to continuity, basically, of the induced metric, but a jump in the extrinsic curvature. And I put that down to some distribution of stress energy. And so I don't know which way around you're thinking of that.
The Israel matching conditions aren't really just an occasion for anything. You first choose the conditions you want, and you use this to interpret them in terms of some
right.
And is Timi new for that background concern?
I don't know.
It doesn't
sound like it.
No.
It appears for an instant.
And is that bad?
Yes.
Yes.
Either not conserved or contains negative energy fluxes. It could be conserved. So
if you're going to match a bounce, a collapse to a bounce, you know you have to have negative. But the general issue of actually using Israel junction conditions on a space-like surface, I think it's not. Is perfectly well defined. It sounds a bit weird having stress energy appear uniformly at a sudden instant in time, but you're using a homogeneous metric. So of course, any sort of some change in the equation of state happening, it's going to happen at a given time everywhere in the cosmos, and you can approximate some evolution of a finite duration you're just integrating over a time interval. Something happens in a time interval and you integrate over it. You're taking the limit.
I guess the question is can one imagine any reasonable physics that would give that an effective description?
To solve the point of using the junction conditions, I think reasonable physics you might be modeling would say be reheating at the end of inflation. That would be you might go through some oscillating scalar field regime, which turns a false vacuum inflection.
Yeah, sure, in general, you can imagine that they've got things that take place on some finite time scale, but in an effective sense, is zero time.
So you could, yeah.
But the question is whether you can get the right kinds of stress sensors for
the bounce. So much harder. So then you have to say, well, so what, to get a bounce in a flat Robertson water cosmology, what you have to do? And people like Rand Brustein and Caprioli put various people have in different contexts, but yes, you need a negative energy source, basically. Something with negative energy, basically. Now, the reason why that is, the only excuse for having something as nasty as that is just that it's applying at high energies and short time scale. So there's some instability, if you like, at that point, but that's what you need. Yeah.
Yeah. What's that? Right. You can solve these in general. If I imagine, so that's the particular situation for the pre-Big Bang, but the reason I wanted to introduce it was that you can actually solve it for more general cases, where the effective equation of state is related to Q by that relationship, and then you can work out the scale factor and the derivative of the scale, the Hubble parameter, and then the derivative of the Hubble parameter. And by doing it more generally, it means that you can apply this to different types of models. For example, the inflationary case, which corresponds to 1 plus 3 W being negative, well, that corresponds to Q here being less than zero. So it's an inflationary solution as R goes to zero. Radiation dominated, which is W is a third, corresponds to Q of one. The pre-Big Bang I just mentioned corresponds to Q of a half. And the ekpyrotic can be modeled to a reasonable degree here by having Q much less than one. So the idea is if you can solve these for general Q, you can just look at the individual cases to see where the differences might arise. Okay, so that's the background. It's this collapsing model. The scalar field is diverging on you. And you can think about perturbations around this. So you're perturbing the background metric. You're perturbing the scalar fields that are present, anything that's present. So if I just think about, say, working the longitudinal gauge, then I can work out and I just think about this set of scalar perturbations, then psi, the scalar perturbation here, basically corresponds to the gauge invariant Bardeen potential, where I'm assuming that there's no anisotropic stresses present. I can, and there are other gauge invariant potentials. Right? And there's the co-moving curvature perturbation, which is related to psi, but involves the variation of the scalar fields that are present. And then a quantity which is useful in the post-Big Bang era, the hot Big Bang, when we've got radiation to think about, is zeta, which is related to these by the variation in the energy density. And not surprisingly, generally these two are basically thought of as being the same, because the fluctuations in phi that converted into the fluctuations in the energy density.
And not beta or sigma?
Yeah, it would be, okay. I'm being a bit sloppy here, it's everything.
What's H again?
Which H?
It's all H.
Sorry. Thank you. Yeah, prime over H, the co-moving. Okay. So, the question. Let me just ask. And that is n equal to 3, 4, or n equal to 1?
Did you put it to
3? 4 would be pre-Big Bang. 3 would be the pre-Big Bang calculation of the ekpyrotic. 1 would be the ekpyrotic calculation of the ekpyrotic. Okay. Or anything else, maybe, you know, is it anything? Is it well defined? And
Is this n in the sense that we know that n is 1 plus or minus pi 1?
Yeah.
That's 3 or 4 are just ruled out.
3 or 4 is ruled out in terms of having this as a reasonable model of structure formation. Then if you want to keep with rolling radii in these collapsing scenarios, you then move up and you make use of your axion. Well, they're there. Okay. They're needed by everyone else. So they've got fluctuations. I mean, I think it is interesting, that possibility.
Yeah. Something though, if you have a number of these fields, and some of them give perturbations with different values in n, just because one of them gives the right answer, is that good enough?
No,
you have to show that that's the dominant.
Absolutely. Yeah.
No, but in the case of the axiom, it's quite clear that, you know, the normalization is fixed at high frequency. So at large scales, what has is number n wins always. Correct? That, I think that's, and by many orders of magnitude. So I think in the pre-Big Bang, if you buy one prescription and you get really n equals 3 or 4, then you conclude that most of the perturbations at large scales are of the isocurvature type to start.
Yeah, but there is one. There's another ambiguity that arises in this, and that there's the actual. I may not reach it. The actual value for n of 1 for this axion actually corresponds. There's a constant of integration, right? That you, when you solve these equations of motion, there's an Einstein constraint which then basically links these scalar fields together, and so there's a constant of integration hanging around, which you can choose. And the spectral index of this field actually depends upon that constant of integration. And the choice of n equals 1, it's amusing, I think, that it corresponds to the static 10-dimensional dilaton solution. No, and that's in this. There are also contributions from the Ramond axions, so should they be turned on as well. And I have a feeling that they can go red. Are they constrained to be just blue? I've forgotten. I think they could go red. So if you were not careful, you know, they could be winning.
Because they have a different power beta.
They have a different power beta, so they give a. That's right. So let me just raise this question over this source of ambiguity, and let me tell you how you can see it, and then we can maybe argue on whether is this real or not. Should we be concerned? So if I can write down an evolution equation for this fluctuation, I'll just write it. They're always depends on Q And then we begin to go through a process that we've discussed on a number of occasions, right, about, and Brian gave a detailed description of normalization issues. This is no different. Well, there is an interesting, I wonder if this is significant. Some people don't like the initial conditions on the pre-Big Bang because they're like you're in flat Minkowski space asymptotically. In that sense, you're big. And yet, and it strikes me that one of the, I mean, from Brian elucidated this, one of the issues is, I haven't even reached Neil's bit yet. I mean. One of the issues is, you know, what goes on at the Planck scale, right? And here you are asymptotically in Minkowski space. You're in the vacuum of flat Minkowski space, and it strikes me it's one of the nice features of this that you genuinely, I think, are in the right vacuum here at the beginning. Okay, so I can introduce a canonical variable, which is U, which for the sake of, I won't go into details of what it is, it's proportional to psi, of course, as a scale factor and Hubble parameter. And you can, the idea of course, you normalize it then to the Minkowski vacuum at early times. So when eta, if you like, goes to minus infinity, so you're normalizing this to the incoming vacuum. And then you're interested in the late times. And by late times, I mean k eta much less than 1, bearing in mind that I want to make sure that I'm doing my calculation. You know, I'm thinking of some mode k leaving the Hubble radius well before I've reached this high curvature regime.
Sorry, so I know almost nothing about this. So you're in the vacuum
initially,
but the universe is collapsing. No. Why aren't you just flat Minkowski?
I've got the kinetic energy of these.
But that's not in its vacuum state. That's,
well, asymptotically, this goes off to, I've forgotten what the actual solution is for this.
You,
but
you give it an infinitesimal time dependence everywhere.
I suppose if you think of it as having a small initial kick, yeah.
And if it were slightly different from place to place, would you get huge fluctuation?
Well, you go through an inflationary period. I mean, this is, I don't know whether you're thinking you're going to generate big inhomogeneities or big anisotropies.
I mean, there's an attractive solution,
yeah,
as you run into the singularity. You get this. So the solution that's here is an attractive solution with respect to inhomogeneities. So the effect of inhomogeneities becomes small if you look at given physical size as you approach the singularity. So there are. So if you kick it off in different directions on different regions, they become, those different regions evolve differently. But if you sort of look, do I mean on co-moving scale? Yeah, the co-moving scale is shrinking. I mean, that's what we want.
Keeping faster to give respect to the
co-moving scale. So it's back to the Hubble, the co-moving Hubble scale. Yes, I mean, that's
not shrinking. It's not decay, you could have only 5. It's velocity, it is time derivative dominated the universe. So gradients are subdominant, but as David is saying, you know, different patches may have different Kastner exponents. So it's not homogeneous, everywhere homogeneous, but in some
some given region, it becomes more and more homogeneous.
On a Hubble scale. But there is no.
What fixes the Kasner exponent here? Is it just the structure of the Lagrangian or the initial condition?
You mean the Q?
Yes.
They're related to each other. That's what I was talking about earlier.
But don't these growing homogeneities show up again when the universe starts re-expanding?
So, if you wait long enough, that's right. Yes. So there's a scale on which initial inhomogeneities correspond to some new, some final inhomogeneous scale. But I think that's similar. That's the stochastic inflation picture that you have to wait. So the question is, okay, how long do you have to, what scale are those inhomogeneities on? So there is an assumption, or model requires homogeneity on some initial, some scale initially, to be sufficiently homogeneous on the place that they are, horizon scale, what becomes that horizon scale today.
I don't understand. This is, the statements that you're making now are specifically for these kinds of collapsing solutions, which are driven by scalar fields. Because in, for general collapse, inhomogeneities grow. If I start out,
not on a Hubble, not in isotropies, I mean, to grow.
I mean, the Hubble scale is going to zero as you approach the.
So the becoming homogeneous on the very tiny scale. So it is anisotropic. I mean, if you don't have a scalar field, a big crunch with a regular matter, the matter won't really be matter at the end of the collapse. So you get something which is more and more homogeneous, although it's anisotropic.
BKL doesn't mean the universe is homogeneous. It means that the points evolve independently.
Locally.
But it means it doesn't care. I mean, things are very different from point to point, but each point doesn't know about what its neighbors are doing.
That's right. So this is, I mean, in the Hubble scale, it's more and more homogeneous. If you look beyond the Hubble scale, you have a very
inhomogeneous. The Hubble scale is going to zero.
Exactly.
On a global scale, there's lots of
inhomogeneity.
Yes.
Yeah. It depends how big you look comparing things to the Hubble scale. I mean, there will be regions which are much bigger than Hubble, and they're still pretty homogeneous, I would say.
It's like inflation.
It's the same behavior
that you have something which is inhomogeneous at the start, and then you are going to shrink the Hubble radius in some local region where it looks homogeneous. Exactly the same phenomenon.
Yeah. So I'm slightly confused about this too. I mean, isn't your initial Minkowski vacuum, doesn't it have a spectrum of quantum fluctuations in this field which is fixed? So you can't tune it to be homogeneous or less homogeneous on a given scale that you like. You already know the answer.
You certainly tune your initial wave function.
Quantum fluctuations, I think this is what you are describing.
Yeah.
I think what people are asking is, what if on top of the minimum quantum fluctuations, you also put some classical energy from the start? How do you wash out?
Quantum fluctuations, it's okay.
That's what
this is what I'm going to discuss. Yeah.
Well, you have to fix what the initial state is.
Yeah, well, I didn't write it down. I can write it if you want.
But what you're saying is that the situation is easier than in ordinary inflation because initially, you are basically in Minkowski, not in a very highly current state. So it's easy to give the initial from this quantum mechanical.
So I'm sorry, was the claim that there's inflation embedded somewhere in this discussion, or is it going to be added on later?
No, it's in there.
It is.
Well, there's an effect of it. The co-moving Hubble length is shrinking.
So even though we have something where scale factor is just going up the power law, it's still inflation. Mm-hmm.
In the sense that, you've got you have modes. I mean, the power of inflation is for fluctuations is that modes leave the horizon during inflation, and then will re-enter later on after inflation, and that same thing goes on here.
But that's only half of the power of inflation. Another power of inflation is that the actual physical, the fluctuations on a physical length scale go down. And here they would go up, right? I think that's right.
Yes. But the energy, if you want the spectrum of the fluctuation, that means it is collective, it's not the amplified. This is the definition that I do with
you. Well, the only point I'm making is that depends. I'm just complaining about the idea that you start in the vacuum state. Because you don't start in the vacuum state. You start with a very small time derivative to the scalar field, which is delicately set up to be exactly the same everywhere throughout Minkowski space.
Why do you say that?
Well, because otherwise you want
Minkowski space. You want to start a collapse. So you start to collapse homogeneously everywhere.
Well, the question is what happens if you have a slight variation.
Right. What if phi dot is a little bit different from place to place?
So I said that it's homogeneous on the Hubble scale, perhaps that isn't enough, really.
Right.
So the next question, I think, though, is what happens on a, so let's suppose on a co-moving scale, what do the dynamics look like on a given co-moving scale? And what you find is, so the energy, the gradient energy builds up because scales are shrinking. However, the gradients, spatial gradients, don't build up as quickly as the time derivatives as you collapse.
So I'll hit the singularity at different times in different places.
But there will be
those
solutions, but these are perturbations basically they're well defined or described by perturbation theory. Because the background solution, which is the kinetic dominated, the time derivative dominated solution of the background is a good is actually approached by the perturbations as well. So things are blowing up, but it's relative. The gradient, spatial gradient energy doesn't blow up as quickly as the...
May I put it slightly differently? Suppose you start out when the Hubble radius is large, right, in Planck units, and you put in a spatial inhomogeneity, which is about the size of the horizon, the initial horizon, so T or whatever it is, or then that perturbation will remain, but will be stretched. I mean, will even shrink, but will be stretched a lot relative to the Hubble radius itself.
Yeah.
So by this time, the Hubble radius is Planckian, these perturbations will be at scales which are 10 to the 30 times bigger than Planckian. So you still have this homogeneity, but it is very, at a very large scale.
But
then it starts at the horizon scale.
Yeah, but then it shrinks compared to the Hubble radius after the crunch.
And then
it shrinks.
But you know, it's a bit similar.
It's a total evolution.
Yeah,
right,
but
here.
Think at spatial curvature in ordinary inflation. You have to have these famous 7 equals to wash out initial spatial curvature so that it doesn't build up again till today. Otherwise, we are in trouble today. So it's a similar situation. You have to start.
Well, indeed, there are limits.
You cannot start arbitrarily close, for instance, to the singularity here. You have to have enough time to, for instance, to dilute spatial curvature. Otherwise, you are done precisely because of what you say, because then it comes back. So there is a minimal duration here, too.
Yeah, there's the initial conditions questions. Of
But Andrei was very unhappy still, I think. Conditions, because for instance, you have to assume that these perturbations were at scales which are much bigger than Planckian, because you want to wash them out by the time you get to the Planckian regime. So you have to start very far away from Planckian to be efficient.
Yeah.
And there you have a big number, which is, you know, this commoving size relative to the Planck length or to the string length.
I mean, another initial condition is sigma has to be fairly fine-tuned to be small, very small. Otherwise, it drives you rather than into this weak coupling regime, it actually drives you into the strong coupling regime in the infinite past if you have sigma turned on. Of course, then you wouldn't, this thing's going to break down on you eventually.
In the 70s, when people looked at this kind of question about all these fields, they tried to fix both the state and the behavior of the singularity by continuing the geometry often in the complex plane. People like Chitra. Have you ever tried that?
I think that's they're doing something not that dissimilar to.
Well, it sort of constructed the Green's functions in the theory by continuing, for example, the Milne geometry.
That's precisely what they do.
Really?
That's precisely what Tolly and company do. Yeah, they go off into the let's see.
Well, the geometry is a nice property with respect to
so they have so this is the Milne. These are the collapsing brains. This is t equals zero. They basically go off into the Rindler section here and then come back in later on, so that a mode will leave during the collapse and re-enter later, but it goes
but
off into the
coordinates mode. Become complex.
Yeah. So their mode solutions, their equivalent of up psi in the complex T plane. They have a left and right moving modes, and one they go around this way. I don't know, that may be upside minus, and then upside plus they did it this way. And this prescription is then tells them what is going to happen at the boundary, if you like, to the field and its derivative. And basically the field flip sign, so phi in is minus phi out, and the momenta flip sign due to this. So it sounds...
I'll take a look.
Perhaps they should take a look at the...
well, it wasn't such great work. It deserves to be rediscovered.
Okay. So yeah, initial conditions issues. Late time solutions to this are can be written so you have growing and decaying modes. Psi minus, the minus is reflecting the fact that this is the solution as it's approaching the singularity. These coefficients depend upon the momenta. So this one is k e to s to the minus q, and this one is k to the minus 3/2. E to S to the 1 plus Q. And now I can ask the question, what is the power associated with these modes, these two? So, for example, the power associated with the incoming A minus mode here, which is just mod A minus squared K cubed, that goes as roughly k to the minus 2q, which I'll define as being, I'll give it a spectral index. Traditionally it's defined, the scalar spectral index is defined as n minus 1. So this tells me that in this mode, na is 1 minus 2q. Okay. And similarly I can go through an argument with it, I can do the calculation for the b mode, and work out an analogous quantity, and this is 3 plus 2q. And even at this stage, there's now if you start remembering what the various values correspond to, you can see that if you were to inherit on the other side, your mode solutions were to inherit this A term as a dominant contribution, then you would inherit close to a scale invariant spectral index for the case of ekpyrotic. On the other hand, if you were to inherit this B mode on the other side, then you will be a blue spectrum. And depending, so for Q very small, it's 3. For Q of a half, it would be 4. And that's why I wrote down here. I suppose I should put N of 0 for this previous band. So you might say, well, okay, which one I inherit depends upon the amplitude and the actual size of these. And if you go ahead and just look, so in terms of psi itself, then the A minus is growing as I collapse. This is everything's eta over eta s here. A minus is growing. The B minus mode corresponds to the constant contribution to the Bardeen potential. So I've got a term that's growing, and that's got a sort of an associated spectral index of scale invariant, and then a constant contribution that's got an associated spectral index, which is blue. And so the relative magnitude of these things is going as k eta to the 1, whatever it is, 1 plus 2q. So for q bigger than minus a half, then it's looking like the A mode is dominating at late times. And so depending on how the matching is done, and depending on which of these you're going to inherit, that will influence the final spectral index that you can expect. So if I now just show you another gauge invariant quantity, which is the one that we usually use, and that's the curvature perturbation on the uniform hypersurface. So this is this R1, which is defined over there. If I solve for that, I'll just go through to give you the. So you go through an analogous process. You normalize the. So you have a wave equation for this, or for its canonical a variable, which I'll call V, which is proportional to R. You normalize V in the initial state. Again, you have a wave equation. You have a solution to the wave equation in an analogous manner to U here. And so the late time evolution of this looks something as coefficient C minus eta over eta s to the 1 minus q plus d minus eta over eta s to the q. This term is proportional to k to the 1/2 minus q. And this term, the d, is proportional to k to the minus 1/2 minus q. So I can look at the associated power with these modes, using the definition that I gave over there, that will give you an associated index with this curvature perturbation. So for NC, you get 5 minus 2q, and for ND, you get 3 plus 2q. And this is the origin of the result that's quoted for the density fluctuations arising in PV Bang type models, that's steep. When you work out the curvature perturbation on these uniform hypersurfaces, then you get a steep blue spectrum because Q is either a half. So for Q is a half, this will actually give you 4, N of 4. Yeah.
So, do you address then the prescription dependence at any point? Because here, how does that come into it? How does the prescription for matching and so on?
So that's what I'm hoping to.
Okay.
I won't answer it, but I won't give you the final answer because I don't yet know it. But you can begin to see the source of it. So you can work out these, as we just have done in the collapsing phase. They're both quantities. You can work them out. They're going to go through to the expanding phase, and what's going to happen to them. If they were to both go through continuously, then they would inherit a blue spectrum and possibly a scale invariant spectrum. And yet, in a radiation-dominated universe, they're proportional to one another. So they can't. Right? So it looks like one of them can't go through smoothly. Unless it happens that this has also inherited only the blue spectrum, then there's a way that they could go through.
The powers are the same. It's not just that they're both blue, but it's blue with the same
powers. Blue with the same powers, yes. So what the matching is going to, should be telling me somehow, is out of these possible ones, which of them, if any, will go through smoothly, and which of them will have to have a jump in order to match the other one today. Okay, so that's what the matching should be telling me. And the argument that's out there is to which of these goes through smoothly and which of them has a jump.
Well, if one is coming in and if one doesn't smoothly match, isn't that telling you somehow that its stress tensor is becoming singular? Or is that not what it's saying?
Well, it's sort of telling you that there has to be an input from the way we do the matching conditions is telling us that there must be an input, almost a singular input to this mode coming in from that stress tensor living on the matching surface. So I think that's probably what you're saying. Something has to happen in that interim.
So that means not only do you have to cook up the stress tensor so it bounces, but you also have to cook up the stress tensor so match the perturbations or something.
I don't know if certainly the perturbations have to match today or in the radiation era. Whether that's too cooking up, I'm not sure.
You don't have to cook it up, but I think there is a general question. There's a question you can ask without having pre-cooked it, I think.
I don't know. What time is it?
So far what you've said is that if you only look at the collapsing phase and you want to know if the perturbations, you start in some sense in the vacuum state and you want to know if the perturbations, what the spectrum of perturbations is near the singularity, that's an ambiguous question. Because you have different ways of measuring the perturbation and different gauge invariant ways and you get different answers. Is that right?
That's right.
Well, I'm still a little confused about this discontinuity. I mean, if you smooth off the singularity in such a way that it's C2 setting or something, and then run today's spectrum of perturbation as backwards through the different, using the differential equations. So there isn't any issue of stuff jumping. The differential equations just kind of right back through this new geometry. Is it then you get to something which you don't like in the beginning?
If we crank it.
I think the perturbations can jump because they can be singular. Mm-hmm. So I think the problem
even
turns out
the geometry is completely smooth, they can be singular?
Yes, because if you have a turning point in the scale factor or a turning point in the Hubble factor, these can make particular definitions, gauge invariant definitions, go singular because the way you've constructed the gauge invariant perturbation can include a term like explicit dependence on Hubble rate, for instance, that the definition is singular when h goes through zero. So there are cases in which both, and this is why there's confusion from which comes out of trying to, you get different results depending on which quantity you interpret. If you assume one of these quantities goes smoothly through this box, black box region, then you can get one result, but if you assume the other one goes smoothly through, you get another result. And so that's the ambiguity. And I think the resolution of that is just that you cannot assume that they are going to go smoothly through.
So even if the geometry is completely regular, and we deal with gauge invariant quantity.
Yeah. Yes.
You still have stuff that blows out. Right?
Yeah.
Yes. But don't you know before you make assumptions, don't you know which of these gauge invariant quantities blows up when h goes to zero from the construction of the gauge invariant quantity in terms of the So what's the answer? Which one blows up?
I don't know if I can answer it.
So the gauge invariant definition of the Bardeen potential, for instance, is, well, you have to give the metric in a more general form. It's something like psi plus h times some other metric perturbations. And so that can make the, I think if h goes through zero, that quantity, that tells you that quantity can actually blow up, be ill defined.
So the Bardeen potential, you're saying, is ill defined if h goes through zero.
But also look at zeta, though.
I think that can as well.
Also has a problem if rho prime goes through, so something like rho prime goes through zero, you can see that zeta has a problem there.
But it's one thing for them to be ill-defined. It's another thing whether it's actually telling you something physical about the perturbations. I mean, smooth out the singularity with some, let's just assume that's done, with, say, some C2, smoothing. So then, what can you construct a gauge invariant variable that does not experience a jump in any of those cases?
So for instance, Gavran recently has given gives a Lagrangian or from which he can just write down a non-singular evolution, and then that defines how the perturbations, and it gives him a quantity which is non-singular, and he can follow that through in that particular case.
That's what we did in a specific. Well, you can say time model, but it's still starting with an action which implements the bounds.
But the limitation of that is that takes a particular physical model. So if you want, so you can argue against that being a general result if you believe that some other prescription would have given you a different.
Yeah. So I think the answer in principle is yes. If I do really construct a regular thing, then there should be an unambiguous way to continue. Now, however, it is also true that if you work with some variables, not all variables can be followed through because of their definition. For instance, some of them contains 1 over h, and h goes, for instance, in our case, a doesn't go through 0 because there's a bounds. So the scale factor never goes to 0. But of course, by continuity, h must. And there are quantities which contain factors a square over h, which in this eta to the 1/2 is something like going from 1 to, from plus 1 to minus 1, they go. But if when you regularize the model, they go through infinity, it goes through infinity. It makes it. So the final answer is unambiguous, but we don't understand how model independent it is.
how regularization independent. So perhaps if you do this complex continuation, you get the opposite prescription.
Could be.
Yeah.
Well, you do.
It seems.
You do.
It seems.
In the complex prescription, what they claim in after their calculation is that the Bardeen variable basically goes through continuously and is related to the curvature zeta, and you can actually calculate the jump that occurs in zeta to match the Bardeen potential, and that's based on that prescription. So here you have two scenarios, both calculable.
And that's in a situation where the background is also non-singular?
Their background is singular. I mean, their scale factor vanishes.
See, if it's singular, I don't really know what to expect. Whether I mean, maybe there's a gating variable that goes through and doesn't experience a jump, versus maybe there's one that doesn't, but if it's singular, I don't really know what to expect. If it's smooth, then it seems like you really should always expect it to go through and just ignore the solution that jump, correct? And why should I trust things that flow up and are smooth?
If the curvature goes to zero and you define one over the curvature to be your Gibbs invariant variable, the geometry is smooth and that variable flows out. Okay, but you have to know what to, you shouldn't try to match that variable continuously.
I mean, couldn't you just choose a gauge, just do it in the synchronous gauge and only relate the Gibbs invariant variables at plus or minus infinity when everything is finite?
Well, that's the.
That's,
that, in some sense, is what we try and do with zeta, but.
Yeah. You mean if you have a regular background, you're referring to this situation.
Yeah.
I mean, it's also possible in a regular, in a perfectly regular background, some gauges are inadequate because you do linear perturbation
sounds
theory,
like
but you get really big entries, geometric, and
this was one of the. Point
that
lies, I
think.
Yeah.
So could you clarify for me what the claims are? Because there are two contrasting claims,
yeah.
And they both get a different index, and they both claim a different quantity jumps in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But are they both claiming that with the same initial conditions, it does evolve into a radiation-dominated universe, that it does evolve so these things end up proportional in the end, or does one of these calculations in fact claim that with whatever are these standard initial conditions, it doesn't end up radiation-dominated at all, you end up with different indices, and that's just the way it is?
The case, they claim they get the different variables are the ones that are continuous. So one would claim the Bardeen potentials are continuous, the other is zeta. The ones that claim zeta, if zeta is continuous, then that's telling you that the spectral index is too blue, and it's k of n of 4. Or n of, well, that so that means it's useless for structure formation.
Just to understand something else, they claim that at the end of the day, these two indices for the two fields are the same, or do they claim they're different?
Yeah, oh no, they're the same today.
And then the other contrasting claim, again, the different one jumps, but is the claim, and you get a different index at the end. But again, the claim is that the index is the same when it's all
yes.
Good.
Yes.
So there's something somewhat robust here, that there's some claim that no matter how you do the matching, these boundary conditions do evolve through to where these things are proportional at the end, or is that also subject to regularization ambiguities?
The claim, I think, would be that it's robust, but I don't think it's been demonstrated that it's regularization independent.
That has to be, I mean, let's say phi has to be whatever it is, two fifths
yeah,
r in the radiation era by the time just before last scattering the microwave background. So
that's an observational constraint.
Yeah, and well, they are all producing models which
do that.
Fit to that. And that's the apparent contradiction. That's why one's right and one's wrong, basically.
I foolishly made an appointment. I'm working on a protest.
Okay. You might ask, well, where does this leave ordinary inflation? And the issue doesn't arise in ordinary inflation where Q. I think I said Q was negative. right, in ordinary inflation. And if Q is, so.
And close to minus one.
So and close to minus one, right. So in that set, in that case, the B dom, let's see, Q is one. B dominates here, so N is 1, and over here, so for the Bardeen potential it does that, and over here you get, I think this term dominating, so N becomes 1 again. So you get the same, so in an ordinary expanding cosmology, these two are perfectly happily related. It's in this collapsing case that we seem to have these issues. Well, we've talked about jumps, so, and I think I've kind of stressed this enough now as to the question. All right. So let me briefly describe to you what's different about the axion. Just to remind you for the axion, well, it's there. L sigma is coupled with this non-minimal term. And that means that it leads to an isocurvature perturbation. And did I write down the... I didn't bother writing down the... Basically, you end up with an evolution equation for sigma is not equal to zero. Normally, this would be equal to zero for the stiff fluids, for the dilaton, for the moduli x representing the extra dimensions. But because I've got this term here, I pick up an extra contribution, and so it becomes dependent on e to the 2 phi delta sigma dot, or e to the phi delta sigma dot, I've forgotten what. So this means that there's a source term, if you like, for the fluctuations, and the net effect is that n sigma can be of order 1, that's subject to some integration constants, which are fixed, you have to fix. Which, as I mentioned, corresponds to the case where the 10-dimensional dilaton actually is not evolving. And if n sigma is 1, it's now an isocurvature perturbation, so it's not of the right form to match to observations, but if you now go through some procedure where you couple it to a massive field and let through the decay of that, then you will generate an adiabatic. Which will inherit the same index, and so maybe a way of generating a scale invariance simply from the evolution of the axion field. Will you have a residual one left?
Yeah.
I think it's. Do you convert all the isocurvature?
It's physics dependent.
How much you convert?
If you thermalize everything and all the local densities are just a function of the local temperature, then it has to be an adiabatic.
So you sort of completely get rid of the signal field?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
But this result depends on the constant of integration.
Yeah. The evolution of the axion, the dilaton, and the moduli, the general solution for that system, has in there, because there's a constraint equation that you have to satisfy, there's a relationship between the evolution of the three scalar fields, and So there's a degree of arbitrariness how you allocate the time dependent, if you like.
If I had more than, you call it integration curve? Or you can call it moduli, okay. You know, the solution has moduli.
Yeah, it's depending how, it's telling you how that's evolving.
On how you fit this moduli, yeah. You may or may not get a flat spectrum.
Yeah.
In fact, it goes from about a half to
minus,
two.
Goes from minus three, minus a half to four.
So much.
Oh yeah.
It's quite. I mean, not only the dilaton, the 10 dimensional dilaton is constant, but quite symmetric in the 9 dimensions of space.
Yeah.
So it's kind of democratic.
Okay. Perhaps I'll tell you, I mean, this matching stuff has generated a lot of discussion, and perhaps I'll tell you what we've been trying to think about, so you can decide if you need all your money back. So, this is with David. So what with we've asked the question, can we come up with a prescription which will tell us which of these is, answer your question, which of these is going to be the sensible thing to calculate to take you through a transition? Where we are not considering the case of going through to a singular scale factor, as in the ekpyrotic. We're considering the case where we can evolve up to some period and then match across to another period. So we will have then some matching surface that we have to deal with, which will have some energy distribution on it. So the question is, we would like to think of this transition as defined by matching across some spatial hypersurface. Let's call it sigma. And that sigma, the case of we're currently considering so that we can apply it to these rolling radii is, you know, sigma could be, for example, a function of the scalar fields that are present and perhaps their velocity, because we've seen that matching affects not just the field but also its momenta. So it could be defined where this surface, spatial surface, vanishes. And we can choose a gauge, a temporal gauge, so that this matching surface coincides with a constant eta hypersurface. It's the same everywhere at all times, at the time that it vanishes. And what we're going to...
surface before or after?
This is just... This is... I'm going to approach this surface. This is the definition of when, if you like, the transition occurs. This is the surface on which the transition occurs.
Okay, so it's defined on the two sides.
Yes, I'm going to. I'm going to replace it with some thin shell of stuff. We've seen that we require some violation. Of some of the usual energy conditions. So rho plus p in positive or something like that. And the way we're going to do it is introduce some source, Sij, which will be localized to this matching surface. And Sij I can write down as a trace bit plus a bit that is trace free. Got my units. So this isn't the axion sigma now.
So ij are spatial indices?
Yeah.
And so what is the first term? There's some extra ij
space. Sorry. Yes, it's a four form. Yeah, P. And we're going to consider small perturbations around my, I don't mean sigma here, I mean delta pi. So I can consider some, in fact it's just here, Vs squared. V squared into, is the induced metric on constant eta hypersurfaces, so it's actually this bit here in the brackets. That bit there. Oh, with an A squared, of course. Multiplying it. And the extrinsic curvature, which will be related to this source, has a term that depends upon the shear, and then a trace free, the expansion, sorry, and then a trace free bit, which depends upon the shear. And I can calculate this in terms of these metric variables. The expansion depends upon the Hubble parameter in co-moving coordinates and the derivatives of the various metric perturbations, and the sigma is E prime minus B. And again, I can set up the quantities that I might be interested in calculating. I just write them over here. The gauge invariant quantities in the longitudinal gauge curvature, which is also often called the Bardeen potential, is related to now psi plus the fact that I've included the shear here. I've got the curvature perturbation on for the co-moving curvature perturbation for scalar fields, and then zeta. So these are the perturbations on uniform density hypersurfaces. These can be related through the Einstein constraint. Just to basically, let me not go into. That's proportional. This combination is proportional to V2 up psi. So if I think of this in K space, I'll bring down a K squared term, which generally means that for long wavelengths, very small k, then this combination vanishes. And these two are related to one another. So it vanishes on large scale. So the thing that I'll just set up for you, and then you can see where we're beginning to go with this, is to start asking, well, what do the matching conditions on this surface, how can we make use of the matching conditions on this surface to tell us about the evolution of the fluctuations? So, for example, we could think of the first is the continuity of the induced metric. So I'm now thinking of this spatial surface, and eta, if you like, is heading up. And so as I approach this surface, I'm in the minus regime, and as I go on the other side of this surface, I'm in the plus regime. So the matching surface tells me that the matching conditions tell me that the induced metric has to vanish, which to zeroth order, I can choose a gauge such that E vanishes, means that the scale factor is continuous across the surface. That's a zeroth order. To first order, this condition relates the basically tells me that the Bardeen, the metric perturbation at psi, is also continuous. And then I've also got the situation on the what happens to the extrinsic curvature, and I know that that has to jump, and that's that jump in the extrinsic curvature is due to the source, the energy momentum source that I've put in there, okay, which I don't know where it's come from yet, but I've put in this source and it's kappa squared is 8 pi g, and that in turn to zeroth order places a condition on the Hubble parameter that is not continuous, as we've been it's been discussed, that there's a jump in the Hubble parameter across this surface, and that jump is proportional to the energy momentum contribution.
Yes,
it's
P.
It's P, yeah, I think it's P, yeah. And there's also a constraint on the expansion, which, if I consider this as being made up of the background term plus a perturbation, then delta rho is the delta p here is the perturbation, and so there's a constraint on the expansion which can be related to a constraint on these quantities, and then on the shear as well. Okay, so I've got these conditions.
So you assume that the scalar field and its velocity are continuous?
I haven't assumed that yet.
I mean, what are the matching conditions for the scalar field?
I can come to it if you want.
But I think you don't necessarily have to think of going from the scalar field to it even being continuous, right? That's the matter content as you go into the surface. So you could consider some other matter. So I'm thinking of the possibility of just having a fluid description, right? Go straight to a radiation description on the other side of the surface. So sigma of phi and phi dot is a description just you can think of as just telling you about the approach to the singularity.
Yes, but you need to connect it with after the singularity.
So suppose you like inflation, you go from inflation to radiation dominated era. You're not really interested in what the scalar field is doing after that transition, but you are interested in the energy density, of course, that the scalar field carried in. But some feature like that is described by the expansion, for instance. So.
I mean, does it include, for example, the perspective of the chaotic people where they have a matching?
If you wanted to look at that, that's right. If you want to do something like that, you would say that, there is an analogous thing where you'd say that you'd assume that the field is continuous, but its derivative could receive a kick from what's going on at the surface.
So I'll wrap up in a second, I think. Yeah. People are getting
ready.
Is it? I'll wrap up whenever you like. let me just, there's one quite nice way I think of that we're beginning to think about the interpretation of the fluctuations what may eventually feed into what produces scale invariant and what produces blue, and that is, you can relate the fluctuations in some of these fluctuations to basically the intrinsic entropy perturbations. So for a single scalar field, where I'm thinking of it as having sort of 2 degrees of freedom, its value and its velocity, then I can define such a perturbation in terms of delta phi dot over delta phi double dot minus delta phi over phi dot. And I can go through, I know what these are in terms of co-moving coordinates. I've got Einstein equations I can use to make use of these. And I end up with the fact that this becomes proportional to the derivative of the Bardeen potential. So the intrinsic entropy perturbation that's generated is actually proportional to the Bardeen potential, or the derivative of the Bardeen potential. And you can go a little bit further and demonstrate that this itself, because I've got conditions on the Bardeen potential, that I know what it is, and then I can use these conditions here, I can rewrite this to say that the intrinsic entropy perturbation is directly proportional to the fluctuation. There's some coefficients that depend upon the matching surface that I'm using, but that intrinsic entropy perturbation is proportional to the fluctuation in the field as I enter this matching surface. So if I have no field perturbation at the surface, then I have no intrinsic entropy fluctuation, or another way of saying it, if there are no intrinsic entropy fluctuations present, then there can be no field fluctuations at this matching surface. What we then do is we're building up a formalism to rewrite the evolution of these fluctuations in terms of these gauge invariant quantities, so that we can then hopefully be able to see how they propagate through this surface. But that's another 3 pages. And it gets a bit...
Any question? Yes. This statement strongly depends on the assumption that the Python surface is given by the function of phi and phi.
This particular, because I expand sigma as a power series in these.
So this, and I think this is the sort of crux of trying to use the saying, can you make general statements about how perturbations go through some apparently arbitrary matching? But if the incoming state, if you've used a single field of description to describe the incoming state, if you've said, then the challenge is, what else could you use apart from phi dot? To prescribe the matching surface. Of course, you can play around and try and come up with other quantities. But of course, you've got Einstein's supreme strength, so the geometrical quantities are likely to be related to these two matter quantities. So I think the hope is that by making this fairly, the hope is that saying that the surface is defined by, is described by some function of phi and phi dot reaching a critical value, should describe basically single field models. But then, having done that, that gives you a linear, if you think of perturbing that to linear order, that gives you a relation between delta phi and delta phi dot on the surface. And that allows you to interpret any deviation of that surface from a uniform field surface. Actually, you can say it has to be what we refer to here as the sort of intrinsic entropy perturbation in the scalar field. And that, through the Einstein equations, is related to the two derivatives of the Bardeen potential. So So one can make an argument, build an argument, I think, basically, that the jump in zeta would be the fact that this surface, you know, would be due to this surface not matching up with, it doesn't match up with the uniform field surface. But that can only be due to this kind of, these kind of terms of pace squared times the bargaining potential.
Could you imagine that the matching condition is different before the singularity and after the singularity? So this function sigma will change before and after.
Well, no. I think you only need, in this sense, to describe when the transition happens coming in from one side, right, from t less than zero, right? You need to know when your single field description breaks down. And then you go into some other description, which I think the simplest thing is to just assume it's some fluid, you know, radiation era. That half rule is where you're trying to get to. So in some sense, this is, you know, Sean was saying, can you just work in synchronous gauge and evolve from, you know, through some well-defined background, evolve through from some time here to some early time to some late time. Well, that's what this matching is actually trying to do. Right? Matching is a description of finite interval in time, stuff happening finite interval. In the limit where you don't care about the details, you parameterize all the information about how that happens in P, PX, or
so I haven't got time to tell you about cyclic, but I'm sure a great relief for all of you.
Next time.
Next time.
Somebody else.
I'm leaving at 4.
Okay. So. I think we stop here.
Yeah, sure.
We continue our other discussions in private. No? Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.